Thank you for inviting me, Dalibor. And perhaps the best way for me to begin is with a tale of two towns on the outskirts of Delhi, Gurgaon and Faridabad. In the 1970s and 1980s, Faridabad had an active municipal government, fertile agriculture, a direct railway link to Delhi, and a host of industries. Gurgaon, on the other hand, was a sleepy village with rocky soil and pitiable agriculture. It had no local government, no railway link, no industries. Compared to Faridabad, it was wilderness. But 30 years later, Gurgaon has become the symbol of a rising India. Called Millennium City, it has dozens of shiny skyscrapers, 26 shopping malls, 7 golf courses, countless luxury showrooms of BMW, Mercedes Benz, Audi, and Gucci, and all the brands you can think about. And it has 32 million square feet of commercial space and is home to the world's largest corporations. Its racing economy is reflected in fabled apartment complexes with swimming pools, saunas, spas, tennis courts, which vie with the best gated communities anywhere in the world. So how did this happen? Gurgaon's disadvantage turned out to be an advantage. It had no municipality and was more or less ignored by the state government. This meant less red tape, fewer bureaucrats who could block development. Gurgaon flourished primarily because of its self-reliant citizens. They did not sit around and wait. They dug bore wells to get water. They put in diesel generators to make up for the state electricity board's failures. They used cell phones rather than the landline of the state company. They used couriers rather than the post office. Some buildings even installed their own sewage treatment plants. They employed security guards rather than depending only on the police. Since teachers and doctors did not show up in government schools and hospitals, they opened cheap private schools and clinics, even in the slums, where fees were less than £3 a month, school fees. Modern India is in some ways Gurgaon writ large. The nation's ascent baffles people. What they see, when they see the stupendous rise of IT and of prosperity spreading across the nation amidst governance failures, people begin to ask, why do we need a government at all with corrupt politicians and unresponsive bureaucrats? And this is when they cynically say, India grows at night when the government sleeps. Now, to rise without the state, as Gurgaon has done, is a heroic thing. But is it wise or sustainable? Wouldn't Gurgaon be better off with a functioning drainage system, reliable water and electricity supply, public sidewalks and parks, and a decent public transport system? Gurgaon finally got a municipality in 2009. Now, both Gurgaon and Faridabad represent the wrong governance models for India's future. If red tape and corruption are the downside of Faridabad's model, then the problem with Gurgaon's laissez-faire model is the lack of basic services. Gurgaon would be far happier if the state were functioning effectively. It should not take 8 years to build a road in India when it takes 3 elsewhere. It should not take 10 years to get justice instead of 2. We find in contemporary India paralysis in executive decision making, a parliamentary gridlock, and the courts routinely dictating action to the executive. While economic growth is necessary for lifting the people, it is not sufficient. We also need honest policemen, diligent officials, functioning schools, and primary health centers. India needs an effective state. The growing at night strategy is not a viable strategy, or at least no longer. And the task now is to reform state institutions. And the current slowdown in the economy is a reflection of hitting a wall with this sort of strategy. The state must now come out of the shadows and become a strong liberal state. What do I mean by a strong liberal state? Such a state has 3 pillars, in my view. 1, it is capable of quick, decisive, determined action. 2, the action is bound by the rule of law, and 3, it is accountable to the people. This was the original conception of the state as imagined by the classical liberal thinkers who also inspired our founding fathers in India, as well as the founding fathers in the United States. I find the comparison with China always useful when I think about India. India is basically a bottom-up success versus the top-down model of China. It's a people success, it's a success of entrepreneurs, and that is why India today has 25 globally competitive companies, which my Chinese friend says, I have a very close Chinese business friend who invests a fair amount of money in India. And he said the Chinese would die to have such companies. Another, beyond these 25 are another 25 to 30 companies who are on the way to becoming globally competitive. And if my friend is correct, he feels that in another five to seven years, some of these companies will become globally recognized brand names, such as we know Samsung and Sony and so on. Let me, for a minute, tell you about this person. This Chinese friend of mine made a huge fortune in one of the provinces far distant from Shanghai or Beijing. But he did not share that fortune with the Communist Party bosses of the region. And so he suddenly found that his life was threatened. But luckily, he was able to send his money out of China and escape. He came to Hong Kong, from where he began to invest in the Chinese stock market, but very quickly discovered that the stock market of China was not a reflection of the market forces or the health of the companies that were on the market. And those bosses, and that's frankly why he has come to India, and he has put in about $250 million into the Indian markets. And but those bosses from the province caught up with him in Hong Kong, but again he managed to escape, and this time to Canada, where he got residency. When you have the kind of money he has, it's very easy to get residency in countries. But they caught up with him in Canada, so he went to the United States and got a green card. And he soon found they were on his heels in the United States, and so he got residency in Singapore. He feels more safe in Singapore for some reason. Anyway, he was in India about 9 months ago, and he comes to me to talk about stock tips and about where he should invest. He has a private equity fund. So I noticed over dinner that he had a bad back. And so I said, "What happened to your back?" And he explained that how he had gone to a factory in Haryana, and the roads were so bad that his back gave way. And so he asked me, he said, "You know, with roads like these, how did India become the second fastest growing economy in the world?" So I explained to him my idea of how India grows at night. And he thought for a few minutes. And then he said, "You mean India has risen with one hand tied?" He couldn't understand this, how a country can rise despite the state. And so I nodded, and he said, "You know, the nightmare of the Chinese leadership, it would be, or is, what if that second hand got untied?" The mistake that people make when they compare India and China is to ask which country will get rich first. Well, both countries will become middle class in the next couple of decades. China is about half of China is now middle class, and India, about a third, is middle class. But with an 8% growth rate, which I think is the proper base case for India for the next two decades, India, 50% of India will also be middle class by 2022. So that's not the race. The race is who will fix its government first. Will China fix its politics first, or will India fix its governance first? Whoever does that is really going to win the race. And if they don't, then both will get stuck in what the economists call the middle income trap, which, as you know, which you may know, that Latin America lost 2-3 decades in the middle income. For the same reason of governance. So India has always been a weak state, but a strong society. Unlike China, which has always been a strong state and a weak society. The fact is, you need both. You need a strong state, and you need a strong society to make that state accountable. India's history is a history of competing kingdoms and political disunity, whereas China's history is a history of empires. And even the four empires we had in India, the Maurya, the Gupta, the Mughal, the British, they were weaker than the weakest Chinese empire. And so the Chinese person was always defined by the state, whereas the Indian was always defined by society. In India, the law preceded the king, and the job, law meaning dharma, and the job of the king was to uphold dharma. Whereas in China, the king gave the law, and then the king interpreted the law. In India, the Brahmin interpreted the law. And so very early on, you had created a balance of power, a separation of power, and a very liberal idea in our terms today. So in India, the oppression never came from the state. The oppression came from society. And the answer to that oppression was the Buddha, or a series of spiritual entrepreneurs we've had. In fact, even today, you can go 50 miles and you'll find a new guru who has broken away from the traditional society. And of course, Buddha was the most famous one. Given this background, India, after independence, could only have become a democracy. And in frustration, Gunnar Myrdal, who came in the 60s, called it a soft state. Of course, at that time, between 1950 and 1990, India was pretending to be a strong state. It was Nehru's socialism and what we call the Mai Bap Sarkar, which means a mother-father government which would do everything. Now this, predictably, because it was out of character, it degenerated into what we call a licensed Raj. And so it was a very corrupt state. But finally, in 1991, the state returned true to character. We did the reforms, and India started growing from below. And therefore, India began to grow at night. And because it's growing from below, I think in some ways it's a more enduring, more heroic and more enduring success. But as I say, India should also grow during the day. And therefore my new book is precisely a liberal case for a strong state. What are the sort of things we need to do to do the reforms? And a strong state, it's an unfortunate use of the word. And maybe when I think back on it, I may not have used the word strong in the subtitle, because too many people think of Singapore and China when they think of, or Russia when they think of strong states. But it's the classical liberal state, which is effective, and it is accountable, and it's bounded by the rule of law. And our movement for corruption, what we call Anna Hazare movement for corruption in the last year and a half, was really the collision of a weak state with a strong society. You know, democracy is an inherently weak form of government. And we've seen in America in the last few years a president who was unable to act. And certainly, Americans, they know their biggest problem is the fiscal problem. Hence, either you have to raise resources or cut expenditure. Otherwise, it's unsustainable. But they have not been able to solve this, the American democracy. European democracies have serious problems with the financing of the welfare state, and yet they've not been able to come to grips with it. So it's not a problem unique. And one of the factors which makes it more difficult is that some of these, of the three pillars that I spoke about, they actually don't reinforce each other. They act against each other. Too much accountability actually weakens the executive. And that's what we found in this Anna Hazare movement, that today there's no action at all because a bureaucrat, no bureaucrat or politician is willing to put his signature on a piece of paper for fear they might be caught one day and go to jail. So the institutions have to allow these things to happen. And certainly, as I said, the sight of a weak prime minister repeatedly humiliated by Mamata Banerjee, who is the minister for the chief minister of Bengal, was too much for most Indians to bear. Night after night, they saw this. One member of the coalition government just vetoing every decision that the cabinet was taking. How to achieve the strong state is one of the subjects of my book. But instead of going into that, in the short few minutes that I have, what I'd like to really talk about is how, in the process of writing this book, I myself have changed ideologically. I grew up in the idealistic days after independence in 1947, and we passionately believed in Jawaharlal Nehru's dream of a modern and just India. We were all socialists then, but as the years went by, we found that Nehru's command economy had taken us to a dead end. Instead of socialism, we ended with statism, and sardonically we called it license raj. For me, those four decades of missed opportunities were accompanied by personal humiliation as I was running a company in India at that time. And I have narrated that story in India Unbound. After the scars and pain of the license raj, I became a libertarian, passionately committed to individual freedom and deeply suspicious of state power. The reforms were a defining moment in my narrative of Indian history. I felt that India had gained only its political independence in 1947. It did not win economic independence until 1991. After that, India's rise has been enabled, after 91, has been enabled by two institutions of liberty: democracy and free markets. For our vibrant democracy, I give credit to Nehru, who laid its foundations, but India rose economically only after Nehru's over-regulating state stepped out of the way. So after that, as a result of this, I began to believe that the state was a second-order phenomena, as some libertarians call it, at best a protector of what people choose to do in private life or in civil society, and at worst capable of destroying those freedoms. I became a believer in laissez-faire and limited government, and celebrated the heroic idea that India was rising despite the state. Now, two decades later, I have realized that I may have been wrong. I am now convinced that the state is a first-order phenomena. It can either allow human beings to flourish, or it can become the biggest obstacle to their realizing their potential. A laissez-faire state, like a completely free market, has never existed. And so the real issue is the extent and quality of government regulation. The state achieves this primarily by protecting human liberty, striving for equality of opportunity, but most of all, by guaranteeing a rules-based order. You know, this book had its origins, as Dalibor said, in fact, in Tahrir Square, where I was invited that day by some members of Egypt's democracy movement and libertarians and liberals in Egypt to talk about India's democracy as a model for the future of Egypt. And the Egyptians asked me three questions. One, how did you keep generals out of power? Two, they said that 11% of Egypt is Christian, Coptic Christian, and 13 to 14% of India is Muslim. The Christians of Egypt feel insecure, but the Muslims of India feel secure. So how did you create that secular state, which gave a sense of security to the minorities? And three, of course, they asked, how did you win that outsourcing business? We'd like to have some of that and get our economy growing. All very good questions. But what they made me realize, actually, was that, in fact, we never asked these questions in India. That particularly the first one, we are not like that. And so what made me realize that our problems in India were the problems of governance, which come at a certain point after you've achieved other things. But a democracy is a work in progress, and you have to keep working at it, doing the reforms. Margaret Thatcher did a huge service to British democracy by the reforms she carried out of governance. And of course, you had the reforms in the 19th century in England. In conclusion, let me just say, because I've been fairly negative about India, that the economic rise of India has been the defining event of my life. It is not only good news for its 1.2 billion people, but it's also an instrument for the good in the world. At a time when Western economies and their way of doing business is under a cloud, a large nation is rising in the East based on political and economic liberty, proving once again that open societies, free trade, and multiplying connections to the global economy are the pathways to lasting prosperity and national success. Thank you.